This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
3 seconds. 2 seconds. The Jets have one goal in their last nine periods, and they get shut out at home here tonight. 2-0 to the first place Nashville Predators in the Central Division.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. Good afternoon, universe. And all that jazz. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show! With the guys that they usually keep on the bench. Well, I guess Ezzy's here. But Dave and I are here, too!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Solid. Pound it. Well, that was the awkward, one guy puts his fist up and the other guy slaps his hand out for the,
That was the House of Ashkenazi slap
yes.
right there.
That's right!
By the way, this intro is way better than Drew's intro.
Right. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good
Ten
morning.
Times better.
All that jazz. Anyway, we're off to a smashing start. I'm Matt Leibel from the Big Show on TSN 1290. Thrilled to be here with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for the next 3 hours. Ezzy Ginsberg to my right, Dave Manouk to my left. That's IC Ezzy G, IC Dave M.
Nope, IC Dave.
IC Dave, sorry. Producer Michael Remus also produces the Rona Roundtable here. It's known as the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, but I like to think of it as... the way one person once put it to me in conversation, three guys arguing about hockey in a deli.
That's good.
The deli show. This is the deli show.
The Bernstein's deli show.
Well, I've got the read here.
Okay, sorry. I went early.
We'll get to Bernstein's later on. But it is great here, and we got a fantastic show for you. Coming up later on this hour, George Johnson of the Calgary Herald. The Jets play the Flames tomorrow night, so we'll talk to George and get the Flames perspective. In hour number two, something cool that started last week on this show, if you heard Richie Pollock sit down with Paul Edmonds last week, it was the first of, what are you calling it, Saturday Spotlight?
Yep. Saturday Spotlight, yep.
So this week, even though Richie and Drew are away, and hence why the checking line is in here, the shutdown line, shut it down, Richie Pollock sat down for a couple of segments with Marty Biron of TSN, RDS, MSG, former NHL netminder. So that'll be very cool. That comes up in hour number two. And then in hour number three, Amanda Stein of TSN 690 in Montreal. Habs are off to a pretty good start this season, fellas. We'll hear about them. And then later on in hour number three, Michael Trakos of the National Post talking a few things about the Leafs, like Jake Gardner, goaltenders, Randy Carlyle, Phil Kessel's weight.
There's always so much to talk about in all three of those cities, but especially in Toronto, where every single win, every single loss is just micro and micro and micro analyzed. Poor Jake Gardner. I mean, I think they're analyzing, you know, every time he goes to the supermarket. But yeah, Michael's always good when he comes on.
Yeah, so that's what's on tap. Also, lots of great conversation. Obviously, we'll talk about last night's Jets-Predators game, the Jets home opener. You heard the final call off the top there. Paul Edmonds on TSN 1290. Remus played that. 2-0 was the final. We'll get into that game. We'll talk about tomorrow night's game, the preview. Some interesting stories about... maybe the Jets looking at making a trade. Maybe Martin Brodeur has a new home. And, of course, Milan Lucic and why he's so good at charades.
Yeah, we want to talk to Amanda about that because she was there. And that gesture, which I'm sure everyone has seen at this point.
I read he apologized.
He apologized. It was a little obscene and he was, you know, fined $50 or whatever it was. But
$5,000.
That Habs-Bruins game, guys, let me tell you, I don't think there's any better rivalry really in all of hockey. Every single time those guys play.
I don't know. Did you see Florida-Buffalo last night?
That's a good one,
Florida-Buffalo is tight.
That's
especially
also
with Luongo.
Yeah, especially when there's 6,500 people watching.
There's no way there were 6,500 people watching that game. We can talk about Florida if you want, but it's going to be a great show. And in all honesty, I'm thrilled to be back here with you guys. I don't get to do this often enough because obviously you have your set lineup with Drew and Richie, but they're both away this weekend. So it's opportunity for Dave to get in here, which is great. He's a behind-the-scenes master with the Illegal Curve crew, updating all the online content. And now you're in here, Dave. And it's a pleasure for me to be here with you guys on a great Shabbat. The Sabbath, the day of rest.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you in the host chair. And as I said on Wednesday, any opportunity I have to talk about hockey and not spend 3 hours with Drew, and it was 2 hours on Wednesday, I'm gonna love it. So
sweet.
No, it's a pleasure to have you here, Maddie.
Thank you. And let's get into it. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are on TSN 1290. We're also online at TSN1290.ca. So if you have to jump out of your car or out of bed and switch from the radio to the online, you know how to do that. Last night's game. We were all there. You guys were up in the press box. I was in the seats. The energy started off great. I really liked the opening ceremony. I loved the glow sticks. Yeah, it was cool. It was a good energy. And then in the end, I thought the first period was okay. My takeaway, guys, I want to see if we gel on this. I thought the first period was pretty good. Again, it was like the Jets playing L.A. You know, they were down at the end of the first period, but I felt like they created maybe even more chances. I thought the puck was in Asheville's zone a lot more in the first period. First half of the second period I liked, and then things started to kind of slow down, get sloppy. But at the end of all of it, I just have two words about last night's game. Pecorine.
Apparently you have some music to go along with your Pecorine.
But for me, like Pecorine, I mean, we could have a conversation. Is he a top 10 NHL goalie? For sure. Is he a top 5 NHL goalie? Maybe. Last night he looked like a top 5 NHL goalie to me. He was the difference. Jets played pretty well early on, couldn't beat him, and I think they got frustrated because of his play. That's the way I saw it. What about you guys?
Matt, he's absolutely a top 10 goaltender, and I think people forget that he was a top 10, top 5 goaltender for many years. He had that unfortunate injury last year, missed most of the season, at least half of the season, and he was the best player on the ice. Yeah, he was the first star, and he's a fun goaltender to watch because he's big and he's athletic. It's unfortunate for Jets fans because the Jets weren't able to put any goals past him, but it's tough to beat a goalie like that when he's at the top of his game. Now, I agree with you, Matty, as far as the first period goes. It was a pretty even period, and I thought the Jets fed off of the crowd a little bit, the opening ceremonies were a little bit longer, obviously, being the home opener, and they fed off of that, and the crowd was into it, and, you know, they had a couple power plays, and they didn't score. Ribeiro's goal was a beautiful tip, and I don't think anybody's going to blame Pavlik on that goal. I mean, it was really a nice goal. Unfortunately, Thorbs couldn't get the puck out of the Jets zone there, and, you know, it resulted in that goal, and they were late to make the switch there. You look at the rest of the game, and it was one of those games where it was fairly back and forth. No team really dominated the play. I actually thought some of the best chances the Jets had were on the penalty kill with Jim Slater and TJ Gagliardi. I thought they did an excellent job on the PK. That's probably the biggest positive of the Jets' season so far, is that they're 100% on the PK, which is really incredible because they've been taking a lot of penalties, especially in the San Jose game. They took 8 or 9 minors, I think it was.
How many did they take last? They were 14 of 14 going, so they're now 18 of 18 through four games. Yeah. So they're averaging 4.5 penalties a game. That's not good. I'm with you on the PK.
You're right, and I think you can take some solace in the fact that your PK is going, but the big issue here, guys, and it's probably something that nobody expected to be talking about after four games, because we knew it was going to be tough to win 2 of 3 games, or obviously all 3 games, especially with the California games, but 3 games, and Paul Edmonds mentioned it at the end of his call last night, 1 goal in the last 3 games. And this team is clearly struggling to produce offense. And I think we'd all agree, Mark Scheifele was one of the best players. He had a great chance towards the end of the game in the third period there. If he lifts that puck up 2 feet, he gets a goal, and maybe, you know, they're able to come back. But
Olli Okunen, by the way. Olli Okunen's the one who slashed him and prevented that prevented the Rays. So,
you know, dropped it for Wheeler in toward the corner. Back in behind the net. Got chopped down by Weber. No call. Wheeler got back up again. Chopped it back out in front. Here's Scheifele, a backhand shot. What a stop by Rennie on a feed to Scheifele all alone in front. And he was in tight. He went to the backhand deep. And Rennie stayed with him and makes a dynamite save to preserve the 1-0 lead for the Predators.
I felt like that was a lot of last night. Obviously, there weren't a ton of highlight reels, but I felt like the difference last night was Pecorine. I don't fault Pavlik for either of the goals that beat him. Nice tip by Ribeiro off this Seth Jones shot in the first period, made it 1-0, which was kind of deflating because I thought the Jets played a pretty good period, like you were saying, Ezzy. And then the goal later on, Neil in the third, would it hit like 4 or 5 bodies on the way to the net? Pavlik was good. Pecorine was amazing. He had a 31-save shutout last night. He's playing like a man on a mission, and it's only October. I mean, Nashville's a good team, but they've got a fantastic goalie. I mean, maybe I'm simplifying it too much, Dave.
Well, you know, the only other thing I think that bears mentioning is the fact that, and Stu Grimson mentioned it, they have an excellent defense, you know, and their defense is just, and they're not flashy. They just do these solid things, and they make sure he sees the puck, and they make sure they clear the bodies. So Rene really, it simplifies the game for Rene because, like, really, he sees everything. And he doesn't really have the work to worry about that. You know what I mean? Like, his defense isn't failing him, and that's important. So he played a beautiful game. He really was, in my mind, the difference of the game. I thought Scheifele played excellent for the Jets. I thought he was the best player for the Jets. I thought Pavlik also was excellent. And I thought, you know what, the problem with the Jets, I really think, and as he pointed this out, They are perfect on their penalty kill, which is important. But the problem is why they can't be taking penalties. This is a team that cannot afford to be undisciplined. And a minute into this game that you've got the crowd behind you, you've got all this energy, and Dustin Byfuglien takes that penalty. I think it was like a minute three into the game. And he goes off. And so the problem is like the momentum that you may have had and you may have been able to start with building on, you know, as Coach Maurice has been talking about throughout the week of practice, was talking about using the crowd and harnessing that crowd. Right away, now you're into a PK. Now, of course, they killed it off and it didn't hurt them, but maybe it did. You don't know that it didn't hurt them because they could have had some sort of momentum build up as a result. So, I mean, it was only one incident to happen early in the game, but it's just unfortunate because I just think that this team, and Paul Maurice mentioned it earlier in the week, he said he's using his better players on the PK. But is that leaving them tired for the yes. power play? And is that part of the reason why their power play isn't as effective as it could be?
And I think what we might see here, either tonight or as the homestand continues, I think we're going to see some changes in the forward lines because you saw Mark Scheifele was creating offense, and he is now expected to, as he was last year, but I think more so guys this year. Now we have the 1A line. And I think last year it was clear that the Scheifele line was the second line. But this year, especially with Blake Wheeler, because he's the best offensive player on the team, this line is going to be counted to produce more offense. And I don't know if that's bringing up Andrew Ladd onto that line or taking Byfuglien on that line. And they're going to have to move some pieces around. And you actually saw late in the game, you actually saw Ladd and Little with Scheifele. And Little was actually playing on the right side. And he's a right shot. So you don't see that very often. But you're probably going to see some lineup moves. And what I mean by that is not necessarily players coming in and out of the lineup, although a guy like Matt Halaschuk might come in for Peluso. I think you're going to see Paul Maurice juggling the lines in practice because they're struggling to create offense here, guys. And, you know, again, you don't want to ring the alarm bell. It's only four games, but when you only have one goal in three games, you probably want to try to maybe make some changes to see who you can get going because Blake Wheeler, you know, he didn't have his best game. But you want to get some other guys going. Brian Little, Andrew Ladd, you want to get some of the third line going. They weren't producing a lot on offense yesterday, so I wouldn't be surprised if you see a couple moves, maybe Byfuglien moving down to the third line, Frolik moving off that line. That's what I would expect.
Well, it's just interesting because, yeah, it is only one game, but it is a three-game losing streak, right? And it's early in the season. And what Paul Maurice spoke about and what is so critical is that putting these points in the bank early in the season it's just so important for your team. So if you're dropping 2 points to a Central Division rival, that's bad. That's obviously it's not good. But the point is that you just can't afford to. Yeah, now look, all the players, I was in the room after the game, all the players said, there's no point in hitting the panic button. We're not happy, obviously. We're not, you know, happy with our effort. We know that this team has more, and that's fine. So they're obviously not going to hit the panic button yet. But at the same time, they know that they can't afford, especially with a 5-game homestand, to be losing games this early in the season. So it's something that they have to address.
Let me ask one more thing. I know we got to go to break. We're going to get into like a preview of tomorrow night's Jets-Flames game when we come back in the next segment. But one thing, we were talking about special teams with the penalty kill and the effectiveness of the Jets so far. How much time should we spend on the power play? Because again, they had a few opportunities, particularly early in the game when they did get the power play, moved the puck around pretty well, controlled the zone, didn't get a lot of shots, didn't get a lot of quality scoring opportunities, and most importantly, didn't get any goals. And through four games, with a number of opportunities, this looks like the story that we've seen for three seasons going on four seasons now. Jets have a bottom third, bottom quarter, bottom fifth. Like, it's a bottom of the NHL power play. Last year they were 25th, and they haven't got a goal so far. I mean, how much concern? You talk about shuffling the forward lines, Ezzie. What about shuffling some things, trying something different on the power play? Because a team like the Jets that's struggling for offense, especially now, and needs something like the power play maybe to get them from a fringe team into being maybe a fringe playoff contender or even a playoff team, to me, they've got to make some hay on the power play.
Yeah, and that's the flip side. You've got 100% kill rate on the penalty kill, and then you have no goals on the power play. So you're happy with the penalty kill, but the power play can, as we know, can really be a game changer within games. It can really, you know, turn a game around. And so I think, you know, not having Evander Kane out there, that doesn't help. A guy like Matthew Perreault has been excellent on faceoffs. He's been the Jets' top faceoff guy. He's a guy that's had some success in the past with Anaheim and Washington. It hasn't quite translated. And, you know, we've seen this kind of look of the Jets' power play for quite a while now with, you know, Buff and Enstrom and Buff loading up the shot. And you're going to continue to do that because Buff has one of the most accurate and hard shots in the NHL. But absolutely, Maddie, I think everything should be on the table right now. They should be looking at what hasn't worked so far and trying to make moves, and you'll probably see that. And by the way, I know we're going to go to break here and talk about the Calgary game coming up, but I expect a much better effort tomorrow. Because for a home opener, considering that you had 4 days to practice, 4 days off to practice.
It was a long week, yeah.
It was a big disappointment.
Interesting note, Perry Pern, who's with the Vancouver Canucks, has their power play percentage at about 23.1 right now. I think they're ninth in the league.
You can say that, but the power play there also features Henrik Sedin and Daniel Sedin and other
different
players.
Different tools.
How many Sedins are there? Is there the third Sedin? Oh, that's it.
It's like the Baldwin brothers, right? Like, yeah. How many Baldwins are there? How many
Steven
Sedins?
Sedin.
I just hung out with one of the Baldwin brothers. No big deal.
See, you don't know this, Maddie, because you're not around the illegal curve Illuminati all the time, but that's who Dave M. hangs out with.
I don't know that you guys are allowed to call yourselves the Illuminati. I think that someone has to call you that. Just before we go to break, the Jets were practicing this morning. Blake Wheeler, who blocked that shot from Shea Weber, I think in the first period, a massive shot from Weber. He was in some discomfort off and on throughout the game last night. No practicing this morning. No word yet from Paul Maurice on the story. Looks like it's just maintenance. So there was some shuffling going on with some of the lines earlier today. You had Little Lad and Bufflin. You had Shifley with Perreault and Halaschuk. And then you had a line with Lowry and at center with, I believe, Gagliardi and... No, maybe Halaschuk was there. It's all over the place. Evander Kane's injuries really hurt this team. On Twitter... At Illegal Curve, at Matt Leibel, at ICSEG, at IC Dave. G Lo wonders, have the Jets 2.0 won any of their four season home openers? Yeah. I believe they're 1-3.
Yeah, they're 1-3.
Who did they beat?
Last year.
Yeah, LA 5-3.
Yep.
They beat LA last year 5-3. There you go. They're 1-3 in home openers. When we come back, we'll stick with the Jets and we'll look at tomorrow night's game. The chance to break a three-game losing streak with the Calgary Flames coming to town, but the Flames might not be as bad as you would initially think. They're off to a pretty decent start. Lost last night against Columbus, but we'll analyze the Flames and how they match up with the Jets when we come back. Matt, Dave, and Ezzy with you. Remus on the board. It is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on a Saturday in Winnipeg.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back. Drew and Richie are away on assignment. So the lineup today, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Manuk, and I'm Matt Leibel. Glad to have you along here.
You know, not a lot of people know that we're related.
And I like to keep it that way. This segment
we're not going to mention it, are we? Okay. What?
No, we can. Ezra's grandmother and my grandfather, my Zeta, were brother and sister.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep. We're
cousins.
As the tribe would say, mishpocha.
That's right.
Which is
Now you can do your read.
Which is a little Hebrew / Yiddish for family.
There we go.
So if you're playing along at home and you got nothing to do, just try it. Mishpocha.
There's a reason why Gary Lawless and was it Mike Greenberg once called us the Hebrew Hockey Hour.
Great name. Yeah.
Anyway, cousin Ezra, this segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest running independent comedy club in North America. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, check out rumorscomedyclub.com. Jets Flames tomorrow night, game two of Winnipeg's five-game homestand here. As we were talking about in the last break, after last night's loss to Nashville 2-0, the Jets are now 1-3, and they've dropped three in a row. So it's an opportunity tomorrow, obviously, to get back on the right track on this homestand, but also to end an early three-game skid for the Winnipeg Jets. The Calgary Flames, who I think a lot of people, myself included, thought were going to be in the Jack Eichel, Connor McDavid sweepstakes when the season started, have actually started the season pretty well. Earlier this week, or last week, I don't know if Saturday is kind of where the week ends or begins, whatever. Earlier last week, Calgary beat Nashville in Nashville in a shootout. Calgary beat Chicago. Jonas Hiller had 49 saves. He was freaking incredible. The Flames have looked pretty decent and maybe... surprising a few people out of the gate. Obviously, it's a marathon, not a sprint. But at this time, when the Flames come into Winnipeg, they are not that the Jets ever have handled the Flames in the past, in the last few seasons, but it's not an easy matchup like maybe taking on Edmonton right now, who's just in the most chaos. The Flames guys look pretty good out of the gate here. I know they lost last night to Columbus 3-2, but they look pretty good.
They look very good. And I still think Calgary is going to be a bottom team in the Western Conference. It's obviously early. They're 3-3 after six games. But, Matty, you make some really good points. And Jonas Hiller has brought so much stability to this team. It's unbelievable. Last year, with Kari Ramo and Rado Berra, they had so many problems in net. They didn't really have any stability there. And you look at this Flames team, and it's young. And Sean Monahan's young. And obviously Sam Bennett went down with the injury, and he's going to be basically out for the entire season. We'll ask George Johnson about that. It's very unfortunate, because even though Sam Bennett, you don't want to expect too much out of a top three pick, he was expected to, you know, make his NHL debut. He was ready. But you look at this team, and to me, it's all starts in the net out, and this defense is very underrated. And I was talking about this on midweek. You know, it starts with the captain, Mark Giordano. Richie picked Mark Giordano for the 2014 Canadian Olympic team. I mean, Giordano is an excellent defenseman. He's a top 20 defenseman in the league. You could argue even at times he might even play like a top 10 defenseman. Might be getting a little bit carried away there. But nevertheless, he's a great defenseman. And TJ Brody's a good defenseman. And they've got Dennis Wiedemann. And the defense is very solid. And then you look at who they brought in. And, you know, there was a lot of kind of, I guess, debate about why they brought these players in, but Brandon Bolig and Derek Englund, you know, they gave a lot of money to those guys, but what they've done is added kind of a veteran leadership with some grit, and obviously those guys offer toughness, but, you know, they've got some guys that can play. Mason Raymond is a guy that I thought that the Jets should have acquired a couple years ago, and then the Leafs acquired him, former Manitoba Moose, but they've got some players that can play, and they've got Johnny Hockey, who didn't play last night, but he's a top prospect, a guy that, even though he's not the biggest guy, they've got some players here, guys, and they're not going to be as bad, I think, as they were last year, but, you know, the Jets can't take them lightly.
Great stuff, Ezzy. I mean, good point. You mentioned George Johnson of the Calgary Herald. He's coming up in the next segment after 12:30. So we'll get a chance to talk to him. But just to kind of take a look at the lines here, which have shuffled a little bit. Early in the season, they had Devin Setoguchi on the top line. He was a healthy scratch along with Johnny Gaudreau, Johnny Hockey last night. But as of what we saw last night, the top line is Michael Backlund with Curtis Glencross and Paul Byron. There's Sean Monahan with Yuri Hudler and Josh Juris, who got called up and got his first NHL goal last night. The third line, Joe Colburn at center. Mason Raymond, another one of those ads in the offseason. Lance Bouma, is that right? Is that what you say?
Bouma
on the right side. And then you were talking about guys like Bolig with Matt Stajan and Brian McGrattan on the fourth line. But, yeah, there's still Johnny Hockey in there. There's still Setoguchi. We'll see where he fits in. And Derek Englund. We'll be able to ask George Johnson about all of that. And on defense, you mentioned Giordano. On our show, the big show during the week, Brandon Rewicki, who's a great hockey mind, he called TJ Brody and Mark Giordano possibly the most underrated D pairing in the NHL.
Well,
and watching them play against Nashville, I saw what he was talking about.
Yeah, I guess he was ahead of me, and Richie's been a big fan of TJ Brody. But TJ Brody's one of those defensemen that, again, he's not flashy, but he gets the job done. Good defenseman. Good pure defenseman. He's good at defending. And also, he's got some offensive talent. He can contribute on the power play. And those two guys are leading the Flames in scoring after six games. But it's an excellent D pairing. And when you have a defense that you know is reliable and plays a good structured game, there's a ripple down effect, guys. And the Jets have been looking for that now for 4 years. And the Flames have that. And that's not the issue. And I know there's been some debate about Dennis Wiedemann's future there. He makes a lot of money. But when you're talking about Giordano or Brody, and again, Brody's only 24 years old. Giordano's a little bit older. But you're talking about the Flames going future. They're going to build their defense around those two guys. And if you look at kind of the blueprint in the NHL, that's what teams do. They build their defense around two or three guys, right? So you see that in L.A. with Doughty, Muzzin. And so, you know, it's a real bright spot for the Flames, along with all of these young prospects that they have coming up.
The other thing, Dave, just before you get in here, that I think the Flames had last year and have got early this year as well, that is sometimes questioned in Winnipeg, they always play hard night in, night out for Bob Hartley. That's something, even last year when they weren't a very good team, Bob Hartley, for whatever reason, has this team playing for him, and that's another thing that is going to make them a difficult opponent tomorrow night.
Yeah, I think so, and I think what's interesting is, the Devin Setoguchi signing, I still don't really understand.
No one understands
because
that one. He's from Alberta, I guess.
Tabor, Alberta, but I really suspect that, you know, if you're a Flames fan, you should get used to seeing him in the press box as a healthy scratch, because he just doesn't seem to have that effort that, you know, that you need to bring on a consistent basis anymore. He just doesn't seem to care. So I think that that's one thing that was a little bit concerning, but that's, like, when the Flames signed him, it's like, they're obviously just trying to flesh out the roster a bit for the year, because it was a question. Move. The Flames are a tough team. I mean, they play tough. You know, they took pugilism practice during their
Brian Burke the whole way. That's a Brian Burke
for sure.
Thing. Completely.
You know,
love
and
they, Chuck Hillens.
You know, yeah. And they said, okay, well, how are we going to get our young guys to be able to handle themselves if they get into a scrap and if a big, you know, enforcer isn't there to handle it for them? But it's a tough team, and I think that they're going to play a hard game. They don't have the most talent, obviously, in the NHL, but they're going to play you tough. And they're going to play you hard, and they're going to give you everything they got.
And the Jets, the last couple seasons, have always had trouble with the Flames. Remember that crazy back and forth shootout game
last year? Smythe division rivalry, baby.
Smith or Smythe?
Yeah, Mike Vernon's playing in net tomorrow.
We'll actually find out. Will it be Rama? Will it be Hiller? George Johnson knows. He writes to the Calgary Herald. Who better to talk to about the Flames than him? The answer would be nobody. So we'll talk to George when we come back. Ezzy, Dave, Remo, Libel. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
I can't believe the Who are 50. You guys see a 50th anniversary tour next year.
Who?
That's right. The Who.
Who?
Your character, Ezzy. That's Ezzy. We got Dave. I'm Matt Libel. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Welcome back. Hope you're having a fantastic Saturday. Good start to the weekend. Tough start last night with the Jets losing 2-0. I rattled my earphones there, but now I'm back. Just before we bring in George Johnson here, a little update from Jets practice today. Blake Wheeler out for maintenance, but he will play tomorrow night against the Flames, and it looks like we're going to get some line shuffling going on. Expect to see Lad Little Bufflin. Expect to see Scheifele playing with Wheeler and Perreault, because Adam Lowry is going to center the third line with Michael Frolik and TJ Gagliardi. Slater, Thorburn, Peluso on the fourth line. So some changes like you were predicting right out of the gun there. Well done, Izzy Ginsberg. Pat yourself on the back. And while you're doing that, let's go to the phones. Reem, do your thing. And we will say hello to George Johnson of the Calgary Herald. Hello, George.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well. How is it going with you?
Talk about the Who being 50. Well, wait till you get to be 57. then Townsend won't be quite so fresh and finicky, I don't think. But anyway, that's all right.
Hey, George, let's just start. Tell us a little bit about the Flames game last night. Just give us an idea of how they played as they come into Winnipeg tomorrow.
Well, I mean, last night kind of was a typical Flames game from a year ago if you went back in a time capsule. I mean, they got behind 3-0. They got... it looked like they're completely out of it. But the one thing that characterized this team last year, as I'm sure you guys know, was the fact that they never gave up. They were in 49 one-goal games. They came back. They tried their keisters off, and they just came up a little bit short. And that seems to be sort of the demographic of this team, is that it's just, under Bob Hartley, is that it's just never going to stop trying. But you just wonder in the end whether it's going to be good enough to make any kind of inroads on that 14-point deficit that they had last year from outside of the playoffs.
George, we were talking about the Flames last segment and Jonas Hiller, and he had the 49 save performance in the win against the Chicago Blackhawks. Can you overestimate, I guess, how important he's been to solidifying the goaltender position for the Flames?
Well, I think it gives them two options. I mean, they were really, really happy with Ramo the second half of last season. And, I think they're still happy with him. What it does is it creates competition in the goaltending position, and it allows them, where we're not in a Mika Kiprasov, position where the guy's playing 65, 70, 75 games, and he's getting worn down by the end of it. And they always used to, as good as Kiprasov was, they always seemed to kind of fade towards the end because, he'd exacted a lot of toll on his body and played a lot of hockey and taken a lot of shots and it just didn't seem to translate down the stretch. With these two guys, Hiller was fantastic in Chicago. You know, like we were saying, he should have worn a balaclava and not a mask. I mean, he was just so good, 49 saves. And they've gotten good performances out of Ramel. I mean, their two goalies are... save percentages are 9.34 and 9.20. You can't ask for more than that. And they're giving up 34 shots a game, so it's not like these guys aren't being tested. So, yeah, no, they really like the combination of them. And I think that you'll see them switching them off and on as we go down the season here.
George, do you expect Hiller to start tomorrow night versus the Jets?
Yeah, I do. He's kind of won the other. And the fact that, they did lose the game last night 3-2, although they had the Herculean third period, I think you're going to see Hiller tomorrow for sure, yeah.
We're in conversation with George Johnson of the Calgary Herald here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
George, tell us about Johnny Gaudreau. Played the first three games, sat down last night. A lot of people excited about this kid and what he can do with the puck. Some people even saying that he might be, or predicting, you know, people do award predictions before the season. Some people have him in the Calder race there for Rookie of the Year. Any chance, A, that we see him tomorrow night? And also tell us what you think of his game so far and what we should expect from him this season.
Well, I mean, he's a fantastically talented little guy. I mean, there's no question about it. And anybody that's I can look in the eye in a dressing room, I want him there the whole year so I can talk to him, so I don't have to stand on a soapbox to talk to somebody. It's great. But you know, he's a really talented little guy, and he's a really nice little guy, and I think he would have taken the sitting, which is what happened last night. I think he would have taken it well. A lot of guys wouldn't have. A lot of guys, you know, their lower lip drops onto the pavement, and they talk about, you know, privately about being overlooked and things like that. I think this kid will take it the right way. How big an impact he can have, it's really difficult to say, because we saw him against half lineups in the preseason, in the Young Stars competition, quote unquote, out in Penticton. I mean, he's Sean. He scored some amazing goals, and he does really amazing things with the puck. He still is 5'6", although they got him listed at 5'9", and maybe 145, 148 pounds. So, he's a small guy. I mean, there's no question about it. But the league now is more favoring towards smaller players with some skill level. I mean, you look at Cam Atkinson last night in Columbus. Had a great game for the Jackets. He's a former Boston College guy like Johnny Gaudreau is, and Boston College is, you know, I had a history of turning out small, really good players. Brian Gionta was one. Joey Mullen way back when, of course. So, I don't know. We'll see. I think you'll probably see him tomorrow night. I hope you do, because the only way he's going to get better. I think if he went down to Adirondack, that, I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether that would speed up his progress all that much.
You know, George, you look at the six defensemen that the Flames are going to dress tomorrow night, or the six that we expect they're going mm-hmm. to dress, and it's a pretty good group. And I know here in Winnipeg, on this station, we've been talking a lot about TJ Brody, who's now in his fourth full-time year at the Flames, and we wanted to ask you about him, because you watch him, and you've watched him on a yearly basis here, and he obviously plays with Mark Giordano on the top line there, but mm-hmm. how have you seen his game grow? Because I love watching TJ Brody play, and a couple of guys on the station here have been talking about how he might be one of the most underrated D-men in the league.
Well, certainly off the top here, I mean, if you look at their scoring stats, Giordano and Brody are 1-2 as a pair on defense. Brody's +4. Those stats can be misleading, obviously, but I don't think they're misleading in the case of those two guys. I mean, Giordano is a fantastic defenseman. He's a fantastic captain. He's just what they need for a young team trying to move forward and trying to, break into that top eight at some point, whether it's next year or the year after that or whenever. And Brody is a perfect complement to him. He skates. He's always skated fantastic. But now under Hartley's given his defensemen, especially guys like Brody and Chris Russell, a little bit more freedom to move up, to join the rush. Brody's skating obviously allows him to do that and get back to cover. And he knows Giordano's there as a safety blanket. So, these two guys have been really, really good. I mean, this team's this team's 500 right now. And, you know, five of the six have been on the road. And if they come back at 4-3, it'd be an amazing accomplishment. And a lot has to do with that pair. And as you said, Brody in particular.
So Josh Jurs' dad canceled a trip to Europe so he could watch his son play in his first NHL game, and he saw his son score his first NHL goal. What was the feeling around the Flames for that young player?
Well, he had a great camp. I mean, he's one of these guys, you know, the Flames motto that they all wear shirts now and pick up taglines and stuff. Theirs is never given, always earned. Okay, right, whatever. But with Josh Jurs, we thought they had earned a spot in camp. We really had. I mean, he battled for every inch of ice. He played very well on a line with, he actually teamed up pretty well with Gaudreau when they put them together in the preseason. So we were a little surprised when, he didn't start here, but he's come back and scored a fantastic goal on a stretch pass by Giordano yesterday to get them back in the game in Columbus. And, I think given his work ethic, what we've seen, I'll have a hard time prying him out of the lineup now.
George, we wanted to ask you about Bob Hartley and specifically his contract, and that's expiring at the end of the year, as you know. You look at how the team has started here, and I know that Bob Hartley's came out at the beginning of the season and said that his contract won't be a distraction, and New Flames general manager Brad Treliving has also said that he's not going to discuss it. Is there anything new on that front, or are we not really going to find out his future until the end of the season?
I don't think we're going to find out his future until the end of the season. I've said it often. I thought he should have got the Order of Canada last year, not a contract extension. I mean, he pulled blood out of a rock last year to get that team, you know, to as many points as they got and to be in competitively as many games as they were. He's not Brian Burke's guy. He's not Brad Treliving's guy. They inherited him. So I think what you're going to see here is he's on audition. No more or less than a lot of his players, despite the fact that he did a fantastic job with this team last year. He has to convince those two guys that he's the guy to take them moving forward. I mean, if you look at what he did last year, points were way more than we thought they were going to be. The competitiveness of the team, like I said, 49 one-goal games, way more than we thought it could be. Outside of Sven Barchi, all the young guys got better. Colburn got better. Brody got better. Russell got better. All these guys got better under Bob Hartley. I don't think he put too many feet wrong last year, and here he's still waiting to see what his future is. He's been really good with us. I don't know what he's like in the room, but he's been really good with us. And I think that a lot of people were looking at this trip coming up and saying, geez, you know, if they go, they come back here 1-2-5 or 1-6, the Heat's really going to be on Hartley. But he's got a chance to be over 500 when they come back here. And he just keeps proving everybody that he's the right guy.
George Johnson, Calgary Herald with us. George, we'll let you go. One more question. And everyone in Winnipeg is going to get this. Maybe you've seen something early on, and you'll understand why we're asking this too, but why in the heck would the Calgary Flames sign Devin Setoguchi in the offseason?
I don't know. It's one of these things where, you know, it almost seems like one of those old Daryl Sutter moves. You know, when Daryl was getting Jeff Friesen and Brian Marchment and all these guys that, I'm sure the way that they will explain it is, we added a veteran presence to the lineup. He has yet to show that he's should be on the roster. He has yet to show that what he, you know, glimpses, as you guys know, of what he once was and what he once did. So I think it's a bit of a puzzlement here. But once you sign the guy and he's got a recognizable last name, you know they're going to stick with him for a while because they made the call on it. So it's up to him to show them that they were right or wrong.
Good stuff, George. Are you at the game tomorrow? Will we get a chance to pop by and say hi?
No, I'm going to be here, actually. I'm watching the Stamps and the Bombers today, and I'm watching the thing tomorrow. And you guys have a great time, and say hello to all my media pals in Winnipeg.
We will, George. You can make dinner plans. That Stamps-Bomber game is going to be over pretty early, so enjoy.
Stop it now. Come on.
Hey.
Well, I don't know. Who's this guy at quarterback? I don't know.
Devin Setoguchi. Good question.
Oh, there you go.
George, thanks for this.
He might be next. You never know.
Thanks for this, George. We'll talk to you later.
Right. Okay.
George Johnson, Calgary Herald. Follow him on Twitter, @GeorgeJohnsonCH. If Setoguchi plays tomorrow... I mean, with Jokinen, there was a question yesterday on our station. Will he get booed? Won't he get booed? If Setoguchi plays tomorrow night, I wonder how he'll get received.
There'll be a few boo birds.
A few. Maybe. Should we go to break? Ez, you want to get in here? You got that look on your face like you want to say something.
George is one of our best guests.
He's phenomenal.
He's always hilarious. He has like these George Johnsonisms, like, you know. And I think the Flames are definitely a team that has found an identity in. It's going to be a fun game tomorrow night because I think the Jets are going to be pumped up.
Cool stuff. Speaking of the Winnipeg Jets, who take on the Calgary Flames tomorrow night at 6 at MTS Center, an interesting tweet from someone who covers the Senators. Are the Jets possibly interested in working a trade? Chevy got that trade bug out of the way with the Budaj deal earlier this year. Maybe he's itching to make another move. We'll discuss and take a look at the Sens roster if there's anybody there attractive. When we come back with Dave and Ezzy, I'm Matt. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Thanks again to George Johnson of the Calgary Herald from that last segment. At George Johnson CH. If you missed any or all of that interview, Michael Remus, our talented, handsome producer, will upload that to illegalcurve.com, and you can check it out podcast style. Because as he said, George Johnson is literally a top five IC guest.
We got, you know what? He is, but we have so many. Like, honestly,
it's true.
There are so many good guests that we get on the show.
It's true. But I've heard him a number of times with you guys, and he is great.
From Winnipeg.
Originally.
Yep.
Cool.
So who do you think he's cheering for? The Bombers or the Rough? Or the, I don't even know.
You know what? As a writer, I hope he's cheering for... I think he's probably cheering for a more interesting game than what's probably going to happen tonight. Because the Bombers are starting Brian Brohm. And the Stampeders are starting lots of guys who have played all year. So it doesn't look good. Anyway, welcome back to Legal Curve Hockey Show. We'll stick to hockey. It's what we know best. Actually, that's not true.
Deli meat, too.
Deli is what we know best. I knew you were going there. I'm Matt Leibel in the sitting in today, getting to keep the host chair warm for Drew Mandel, who is away. Richie Pollock also away, so I'm here flanked with Dave Manuk and Legal Curve regular member, I guess, Ezra Ginsberg. Speaking of new lines, in case you're just joining us, Jets are going to have new-look lines tomorrow. Quickly, Little with Ladd and Bufflin. Shifley with Wheeler and Perreault. Adam Lowry centering the third line with Frolik and TJ Gagliardi. Slater with Peluso and Thorburn. We can talk about that maybe a little bit later on. But, Ez, did you want to read this this tweet from Bruce? I can never remember how to pronounce his last name. Gariok? It's a ch.
It's a k as opposed to a ch.
So it's not Gariok.
It's not choo-choo. Right. It would be if it was...
Cuckoo.
Cuckoo.
So do you want to read this Bruce Gariok tweet?
Those, by the way, those last 10 seconds, no one's getting back. If anybody wants those, if anybody's listening out there, hopefully people are. You're not getting those 10 seconds back. So it's
sorry about
Bruce
that.
Gariok. They actually had Bruce on HNL on Thursday, I believe.
Okay, yeah. Writes for the Ottawa Sun.
Writes for the Ottawa Sun, yep. Of course, we've met him. Very nice guy.
Is there an echo in here?
Nope.
I'm anyway, do you want to read the tweet? We're running out of time here.
The tweet, yeah, exactly. The tweet was in reference to the Jets having two scouts. Well, the quote exactly, the tweet, I guess, was, I believe the Jets had a scout at every Sens game on the road, and then tonight they have two, and I believe that tweet was on Wednesday.
Thursday night.
Thursday
the Colorado night, game, right?
At the Colorado game, and the Senators won that game.
5-3.
Yep, and... So it's interesting because, first off, you know, and I tweeted this yesterday, there were scouts watching the Jets yesterday. Todd Woodcroft, who's the director of pro scouting for the Calgary Flames, he was one of them, and they had a Hurricane scout. Every team scouts every team. So it's not, I mean, it's not odd for there to be, there's always going to be pro scouts. If you look at, you know, up in the press box, and I tend to do that to see who's there. I want to know if Remus is there because then I know that I have to be first to the popcorn. But, you know, I like to see, you know, just take note and you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, a guy like Dave Semenko is actually at Jets games quite a bit, scouting for the Oilers. But, so, you don't want to raise alarm bells as far as, okay, well, are the Jets, you know, targeting someone in Ottawa? Well, part of pro scouting is just scouting players because you're going to be playing them.
Being aware.
Being aware. So, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're scouting them for the purposes of a trade, but I think what Bruce's tweet kind of was inferring is that there might be somebody that they're watching. So, you know, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about maybe some of the players that the Jets could possibly be looking at on the Ottawa Senators, and there aren't a lot.
I was looking at the Ottawa roster in preparation for the show. To me, it starts, the conversation starts, because there's a couple layers, right? Who are the Jets going to move to make a trade? Who would they be interested? But for me, it all starts with, what are the Jets' needs? Now, I think they still have the same need that they had going, you could argue, through the whole offseason that wasn't addressed, that they still have, and that's defensive depth. I mean, Mark Stewart is on the... I mean, he was on the first pairing yesterday with Trouba. Some people like that, some people don't. Bogosian Enstrom's pretty solid, but you've got Postma with Party. I mean, there's possibilities to improve defensively. But I think the other new element to a possible Jets trade talk that they could maybe move early in the year is the fact now that Evander Kane is gone and going to miss probably at best a quarter of the season, at best, would they want to try and get a forward with 1 year left on his deal or something like that to kind of fill the gap? Especially with them struggling to score goals so early on in the season here. So to me, those are the kind of the two areas where maybe the Jets would be looking. But as you mentioned, there's no one really on Ottawa that jumps out at either of those categories, at least not to me, as.
Right, I agree with you. And obviously, I mean, are the Jets looking at specifically a top six player for the Ottawa Senators? Well, it's probably not Bobby Ryan, who just signed an extension with the Ottawa Senators. It's probably not Clark MacArthur. It's not Kyle Turris. So you have to wonder, well, maybe is it someone, a younger player, you know, that's maybe filling a depth role, so to speak, for the Jets, or is it someone that they're maybe looking at as a top four defenseman? And to me, it could be, and again, I'm throwing names out there, not necessarily, I'm just looking at fits for the Jets on that left side. So you're talking about Jared Cowan and Patrick Wierkoch, two excellent defensemen, guys that are still growing. Wierkoch was good specifically during the lockout, and he struggled a little bit. He's been in and out of the lineup, and you look at Jared Cowan, who's a first-round pick, big guy. Him and Cody Ceci, they're kind of the future of the Senators' defense. Are they looking at those guys? Are those guys maybe somebody that they'd be willing to move someone for in as part of a trade? Now, again, we're completely speculating here. There's other interesting players, and I think you look at who's made the team this year, Curtis Lazar, who was a 2013 pick. I don't think the Senators are trading Curtis Lazar. I mean, he's a guy that they have a lot invested in. They look at the future of their team, and they see, you know, Kyle Turris along with Bobby Ryan, and they see Mika Zibanejad, who was drafted in the Scheifele year, 2011. You know, are they looking at a guy like Mark Stone? He's from Winnipeg, put up big numbers, Brandon Wheatkings. I think, you know, again, we're completely speculating here. You could do this with any team, really. You could kind of, who would be a good fit with the Jets? Who would a team move and all that? I think, though, when you get back to how the Jets have started, and they've struggled to score goals, and I think, you know, defensively they've had their issues. I think you know, against teams like LA and San Jose, they obviously have trouble defending better teams like that. But I think it's interesting just to kind of think about what the Jets are looking at around the league and specifically here. And again, you know, Bruce Garriott, who's a great journalist, he's not saying a trade is imminent by any stretch of the imagination. But I wouldn't be surprised, guys, if we see a move and before the trade line deadline from the Jets. And again, I'm not, you know, trying to stir the pot here. Maybe I am trying to stir the pot here.
You're literally actually stirring a pot as you're telling
but
story.
This is my point, Matty.
What is your point?
My point is, Palmer. This is the exactly. You know, I get now. You're playing the role of Drew, because Drew's always saying, "What's my point?" I ramble on like Led Zeppelin. So, you know, I look at this Jets team, and Paul Maurice this is his first year as Jets coach. So Paul Maurice isn't going anywhere.
Okay.
And most of this core hasn't gone anywhere. And if you look at, well, if the Jets continue to struggle, what are they going to do? Are we going to see call-ups? Are we going to see someone come up from the AHL? It's possible. But, I mean, there's only a few players that really – and Eric Odell is just coming off – is injured right now.
Right.
And Patrice Cormier is coming off an injury. So, I mean, you know, if the Jets struggle to score goals, we might have to see a move here.
The truth is, and what's key, I think, is what happens with Evander Kane when he gets reevaluated on the 23rd. I mean, as Coach Marie said, you know, at that point it becomes week to week, not month to month, which is important. But, of course, you know, I mean, like I said, you just can't afford to lose a scorer of his – you know, capability this early in the season. And, I mean, that shouldn't be discounted when you're talking about what this team needs and what it doesn't have.
It's a great conversation. We have to leave it for now. When we come back, we'll begin hour number two with the Saturday Spotlight. Richard Pollock, who is not here today, earlier in the week, sat down with Marty Biron, a two-part interview that will air from 1 to 1:30. Do not miss it. So we'll see you on the other side of the 1 o'clock break. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Dave, Ezzy, Matt, and Remo on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back. It is The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm Matt Leibel from The Big Show on TSN 1290. Pleasure to be in today with Drew and Richie on assignment. It's a new look line. That's the theme. That's the theme with the Jets. Adam Lowry is going to be centering a line for the first time this season tomorrow, so I thought I'd give it a try.
Yeah, you're centering.
I'm centering a line. Yeah. It's funny because Lowry is number 17. If I was going to have a number, it would probably be 18. Though there is a guy on the Jets.
A little
Jets. High. Yeah, a little high. The problem is my two favorite numbers would be 18 or 16, and those are taken. 16 is my birthday date in the month, you know, like, and then 18 is a good number for our tribe. But no luck. Anyway, Adam Lowry is going to be centering a new look line on the third line for the Jets tomorrow. So it's a new look line for Illegal Curve today. Ezzy at right wing, Dave Minuk at left wing, Remus and Nett. And I'm Matt Leibel, and it's great to have you along. But even though Richie's not here, we've got this new feature on Illegal Curve. Richie sat down earlier in the week with Marty Biron, and here in two parts. Here's the first part of that interview.
Saturday! Saturday! Saturday!
The O'Legal Curve, Saturday Spotlight.
You know, Marty, I want to go back all the way back to 1995, your draft year, drafted in the first round of the 1995 entry draft to the Buffalo Sabres. And I want to
the
get
O'Legal
back to
Curve,
the mindset at that
Saturday
time.
Spotlight.
You drafted, probably the most exciting day of your career to that point. When you got drafted by the Buffalo Sabres, kind of in the peak. You know, Marty, I want to go back all the way back to 1995, your draft year, drafted in the first round of the 1995 entry draft to the Buffalo Sabres. And I want to get back, you know, get to your mindset at that time. You got drafted, probably the most exciting day of your career to that point. When you got drafted by the Buffalo Sabres, kind of in the peak, in the beginning of the peak of the Dominic Hasek years, what went through your mind?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny you say maybe the most exciting day of my hockey career at that time. It was probably the second most exciting day because the year before I got drafted in juniors in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, and that was the most exciting day because it was so unexpected. You know, you work your midget year, your Bantam midget year, and then all of a sudden you get drafted in the first round in the queue and in my hometown nonetheless. So that, at that moment, I remember just shaking, walking off the stage. And now you've experienced that once, and then you play a whole year of juniors, and you have a lot of success, and scouts are coming to see you, and teams are talking to you, and you do the interviews and all that. So then when I got to the NHL draft, I was kind of knowing what to expect a little bit. And then I'd lost a little bit of a sponsor, even though it was the NHL, I'd lost a little something because there was such a build-up to it that I thought it was going to blow it right out of the water from where it was juniors, and it didn't. But you're right, it was right at the middle of Dominic Hasek's incredible, you know, Hall of Famer career with the Sabres and his six Vezina trophies and two MVPs, I think. And but I remember the only place I did not want to get drafted to was the New Jersey Devils because of Brodeur. And, you know, I was like, that's the only place I don't want to go to. I could care less wherever I go. And I was kind of mad because I wasn't the first goalie picked in the draft at the same time. John Sebastian Jagr got picked by Hartford maybe three or four spots ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And then Jay McKee got drafted first with the Buffalo Sabres, and they worked a deal with Vancouver that they traded McGillney there. They got Michael Pekka, Mike Wilson, and then a first-round pick. And so I knew they had gotten an extra first-round pick, so I thought this was going to be maybe a likely destination for a goalie. And then I was drafted there, which I was so thrilled and excited because I was a huge Quebec Nordiques fan. And that summer, the Nordiques moved to Colorado, so I'm like, well, great. Then my family and I are just going to start cheering for a new team, and it became the Buffalo Sabres.
Isn't that interesting? And you came out of the QMJHL, Marty, as you mentioned, and really known as a goaltending factory back then. Do you think that's changed? And if so, why do you think that?
Well, there's a few contributing factors to that. One, I really think that losing the Quebec Nordiques and having just the Canadians there lost a lot of its luster towards hockey, the competitive nature and the rivalry that the Montreal and Quebec City had with their sports, with their hockey. It brought more people engaged in the game. When the Nordiques left, a lot of people started spending their money in ski and other activities with the family because they had, you know, the hockey kind of lost that buzz around our city. So that was one. And two, when I was at the same age, I was working with the Allaire brothers in the summer and getting ready for training camp and their summer camp, you know, as a 17, 18, 19-year-old kid to get to my pro. And now the Allaire brothers are working with NHL teams, and they don't have summer camps anymore, and they don't do minor hockey stuff. So it lost a lot of its goalie training in the province of Quebec, which, you know, if you look at all the goalies that came out of my year and before that and even some after, they all went through that goalie school. It was the premier goalie school in the world to be able to develop goalies, and then they just started doing other things, and they had been doing it for 15, 20 years, so it's time for them to move on to something else. So that was a big reason for it. And then the rest of the world just got caught up, you know, with the internet and, you know, everything being able to advance much more faster than it has been in the past. the Western Canada caught up, and now a lot of goalies come out from Western Canada. Europe caught up. Swedes and Finns are extremely dominant in the league right now. So there's a lot of different factors, but those are the top three, I would say.
You know, you mentioned being a Quebec Nordiques fan growing up. Who was your favorite goaltender when you were growing up as a kid in Quebec?
Oh, man, there was whoever was playing that year. I mean, I remember going as far as Daniel Bouchard in the early 80s to Mario Gosselin in the middle 80s. And then there was a guy named Mario Brunetta. There was Gart Snow for a little bit, Stefan Fizet, and Ron Ekstall. I mean, whoever was playing goalie at the time was the one I watched. I loved that team, and I was really excited to be, to be going to games and to be growing up in that area. So I was just, you know, if they were wearing the pads and they were in nets, I was a big fan of them.
You think the team's going to come back in the next couple of years?
I don't know in the next couple of years, but I think that before 2020, there will be another team in Quebec City. I mean, the same dream is alive there as it was in Winnipeg for many years, and you know, they were able to come through with having a building that was feasible for the NHL, and now that building in Quebec City is in the final stages of completion, and that is definitely going to help bringing an NHL franchise back to Quebec City. The support is there, the fan base is there. To be honest with you, the Montreal Canadiens should be the top advocate for it because they've lost that luster. They lost that sense of accountability and trying to be better because the market is theirs and there's nobody else fighting for it, and they haven't won a cup since before the Nordiques left. So really, that is what they should want. They should want another team so it makes everybody better in the area.
We're joined by Marty Biron, the second edition of Saturday Spotlight on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Marty, you know, we talked about taking over for Dominic Hasek, which you eventually did in the early 2000s. How much pressure did you feel, you know, taking over for, you know, at least in my opinion, the best goalie I've ever seen?
Well, it was kind of funny when Dom was set to play his last year and retire, because that's what he wanted to do. Somebody asked me, is it going to be tough to fill his shoes? And I remember answering saying that Dominic Hasek is not going to leave any shoes behind. I'm going to have to find my own pair and go forward because nobody else, nobody in the history of the game could fill Dominic Hasek's shoes. He did this, he played his game his own unique way, and that was it. Now, that year he was plagued with injury and then came back another year, which I got to learn more from him, and then ended up moving on to Detroit and retiring and coming back and all of that, which we don't have to go into. But the pressure was different. When Dom went to Detroit, our team ended up going through bankruptcy. The Regas family owned the Sabres at the time, and I remember everybody was leaving. Our top players were being traded away for draft picks and money, and it was a very weird time. So the pressure to perform and to be winning games wasn't there as much as you would think it is, because we were just trying to survive. We were just trying to play the games, and hopefully the team was going to stick around long enough for us to be able to see the young talent develop. And when it got to that point where the young talent developed, well, unfortunately for me, there was a young goalie named Ryan Miller that had played a year in Rochester during the lockout where I didn't play any hockey, and he was ready to step in, and I was pushed aside a little bit and then before I went out to Philly. So the pressure really was different. It wasn't so much a pressure to perform or to replace Hasek. It was more a survival for our team to stick around.
You mentioned Dominic Hasek and Ryan Miller. You know, thinking about it from an outsider's perspective, Martin, and not having played goal before, but how different is it for goaltenders when there's two of you on the roster and you know you want to have a camaraderie between the two of you, but also there's only one starting goaltender, whereas you know if you're a young center like Daniel Briere and there's Chris Drury, you can help each other out knowing there's enough ice time to go around. How do you balance that?
Well, it depends the situation you're in. When I was with Hasek, I was just a young player coming through, and I was happy to play 10 games out of the year, or 15 if I had to. I was happy to go to practice and learn from Hasek and learn from our goalie coach at the time, Jim Corsi, and go on the road and watch other goalies perform at the time. I mean, it was Curtis Joseph, it was Patrick Waugh, Marty Brodeur. I was just a sponge. I just wanted to take in all the information I could and be able to use it for my own benefit later in my career. Now, when I played with Ryan Miller, it was different. I felt it was my time to be. I had suffered and paid the price for many years in Buffalo, and I was feeling like it was my time. So I was definitely competing for more. If I had a chance to play back-to-back games, I wanted to put those games away and be a standout so I would get more. My first year with Ryan, he injured his thumb. I needed surgery and missed about 20 games. Well, I went on a 13-game winning streak, and I was hoping that was going to be enough for me to retain my number one job. Well, when he came back from injury, you know, obviously if you're the number one, you're hurt, you come back, they're going to give you a chance. He took it and played really well, so I was put on the bench again. And that was tough. I wanted to be a number one. I wanted to move to a different organization if I had to, and that chance was given to me when I went to Philly. So there's different situation. If you look later in my career, I played with Lundqvist in New York, and mm-hmm. I was extremely happy to be his backup and hopefully use some of my veteran leadership and veteran experience to help him, to help some of the younger players on the team. And so there's different scenarios and different circumstances for backup. They're never the same.
You know, you mentioned Jim Corsi, and obviously that Corsi phrase has become kind of a catchphrase in the hockey industry. Martin, when Jim was your goaltending coach, how much did he actually use stats to, you know, guide you and coach you?
He didn't really use a whole lot of stats with me. I think that got developed after I left, where he used a lot of the shots and block shots and missed shots to really think in the goalie's workload. I mean, you can have a 20-shot night, but you might have faced 75 shots that you had to get ready for. Mm-hmm. It's not because they didn't hit you that you didn't mentally prepare for it, physically react to it. That was really the workload measurement for Jim Corsi. Now, the Corsi stats, when it came to seeing if a team, the possession of the puck and all of that, came from a different place. But it was Jimmy's idea to really look at the goalies, because he always was the biggest advocate for the goalies. He was our best friend, our biggest supporter. It didn't matter if we'd lost 10 in a row, he still thought we were the best goalies and that we deserved Vezina trophies, and if they could give two, it was going to be his two goalies getting them. And that's really the way he was, and it was great.
Yeah, and you mentioned moving from Buffalo to Philadelphia. You go in a trade for a second-round pick to Philly and get an opportunity there. You make a playoff run, Martin, in 2008. The Flyers beat Washington the first round, go to seven games, and you surprise Montreal. Surprise to some people, surprise Montreal in round two. Then you play the Penguins in the conference finals. You know, there's injuries in the series. I believe Timonen and Coburn get hurt. Do you ever think about that series, that opportunity, and what if?
Absolutely. I remember the Washington series like it was yesterday, and the Montreal series as well. That game seven against the Capitals, we were up 3-1 in that series and lost game five in Washington, came back to Philly for game six and lost it again. Then we had to play the very next day, so we had to get on the train. And I remember that train ride to Washington being one of the loneliest train ride I've ever had, sitting in the dark by myself thinking, what are we getting ourselves into going to that hostile environment? Because Washington's a very loud, tough place to play, especially at that time, against a team with Ovechkin and everybody that was such a high-powered offense. And then Chris Beliveau, who had played out of his mind since being traded from Montreal to Washington. And I'm like, how are we going to do that? That was 24 hours that was just crazy in emotion. But then going to Pittsburgh, that rivalry with the Penguins, the year prior to that, the Penguins won all eight games against us. The year I got traded to Philly, the year we finished last, they had a psychological advantage on us that was probably very measurable out there. And we go in, you know, taking. If I remember correctly, we lost both games in Pittsburgh, and then after that, it just. You know, we didn't have anything else. Like you said, we lost Coburn, we lost Timonen, and I remember losing Chemo to blood clot, and it was just, you know, a bad news coming on top of all the other news that we got, and everybody was exhausted we didn't have any more juice, and you know, it was, we were ripe for the picking, and Pittsburgh did exactly that.
And you lose that season in the conference finals. You come back the next season, and you guys lose in the first round. That's the, you know, that off season is where you head elsewhere, Martin. Are you surprised that Philly, and I know money plays into it in a sense, but are you surprised Philly, considering your success there, and you performed very well there, went with Ray Emery, eventually Brian Boucher and Michael Layton in that season, when you see, if you're looking back, how close the Flyers were to winning the Cup?
Absolutely. I was really surprised, and I don't think I've told many people this, but I remember after Game 7 in Washington the year before, and I was standing outside by the bus, and Paul Holmgren came up to me, and he was so happy, and, you know, the performance, I had played really well in that game, and he said, you know, Marty, I'll always take care of you. You'll be a Flyers for a long time. That game alone set it up, and I was excited. I was like, man, this is such a great organization, and I respect Paul Holmgren and the whole Flyers organization, and I was really happy. And that summer, after the conference final, you know, everybody re-signed. You know, players got, Colburn signed an extension. I remember, I want to say Carter and Richards probably got mm-hmm. their extension done. And I was the only one that hadn't signed an extension. And I was starting to feel the pressure that, man, I thought I was going to be at the top of the list, and maybe I'm not. And then the year went, and it was always a matter, every discussion was, it's not a matter of if we sign you, it's a matter of when. It's a matter of when it gets done, not if we get it done. So I was like, okay, business as usual, and then the season ends, and we lose to the Penguins in six games in the first round, which they eventually won the Cup, and I didn't play badly. I played all right in the playoffs. It wasn't my best, but again, Pittsburgh was always a very tough place to play, and all that firepower, and then, you know, I'm trying to see if there's going to be an opportunity to sign, and there was some miscommunication between the organization and me through my agent and all of that, and then all of a sudden Ray Emery is going to sign, and I'm left without a chair to sit on for musical chairs. So I'm sitting, 3 weeks has gone by, July 1st, and I still don't have a contract offer. It was a really tough time. And I thought this was going to be such a great opportunity for me to just be with another organization and be there for another 5, 6, 7 years and have all that success, and it didn't happen. So that was really tough.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew and Richard away, but earlier this week, Richie sat down for a conversation with former NHL netminder and current analyst Marty Biron. We just played part one of that interview. We call it the Saturday Spotlight, a new feature here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Without further ado, let's get into part two. This is Richie Pollock with Marty Biron.
When you look back at that and you see I appreciate how forthright you've been, and you look back and you see the way it ends for the Flyers that next year in the finals against the Blackhawks, and goaltending was an issue, Marta, in the finals especially, do you really think, you know, I would have raised the team to a different level, and I could have been a Cup winner?
Well, I was thinking that, but then comes the general manager in me or whatever that says, well, you know, obviously, you know, Ray Emery was there, and then he got hurt, and then it became Michael Layton and Brian Boucher, and they didn't have a very expensive goalie tandem there, so they were able to bring in players like Chris Pronger and really bolsters up their defense and their system, so not as much pressure was going to be put on the goalies. I have no idea if we would have been successful if I had stayed in Philly or not. That was a direction that they took, and at the time you looked at the Detroit Red Wings really putting a ton of money in their defensemen and their top six, so they wouldn't have to rely as heavily on Chris Osgood or whoever was in net. And that was the way that the NHL was kind of looking at building their franchise. It changes every 3, 4, 5 years, especially when it comes to goalies. Going with two good goalies or one number one that's going to play 70 games, there's no really set ways of doing it. But I'm not the kind of player, a person to look in the past either and say the what ifs, and that's the way it happened. I went to the island, I tried to have a good year, and then it didn't really work out for me, and then I had a great time with the Rangers. We went to conference finals, and You know, last year I retired, but they went to the finals, and I still felt I was a little part of it. So, you know, there was no regret at all. And I still see some of the players and some of the trainers and some of the people in Philadelphia and some of the front office people that I dealt with when I was there. And I have, you know, nothing but good things to say because they're just doing their job, and I was trying to do mine as well.
Joined by Marty Biron on the second edition of Saturday Spotlight on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Martin, you mentioned the contract negotiations, and just like throughout your career, I know there's different types of players. Some players you say to the agent, take care of it, I don't want any part in it. Other players who are very involved in their negotiations. Where did you fall along that line?
I was kind of an in-between. I would try to have as many conversations as I could, and I was trying to be as involved as I could, but at the same time, you have to be able to play hockey. You have to be able to focus on the game and not really rely on that. So I remember after the 1999-2000 season where I played 35 games with the Buffalo Sabres when Hasek was hurt, I started the next season. I was a holdout at training camp. I didn't sign with the team until late in October, and I don't think I joined the team until the first week of November. But I remember having countless meetings with Darcy Regier, who was the GM of the Sabres at the time, and my agent, and sitting at a Chili's restaurant here in Buffalo and writing things down on napkins and giving my 2 cents on thing. And so, I mean, I was just a 22, 23-year-old guy, and you know, just wanted to be able to be as involved as I could. Now, was it the right way? I don't know, but who knows? Maybe it helped me build some kind of understanding of the game for now, what I'm trying to do in the new career, and take that and put it in the bank and go. And that was that's the way I always felt about things.
And you mentioned Darcy Regier, and Lindy Ruff is the coach you played for the first 8 years of your career. You head out of Buffalo, which we just spoke about, and you play for five coaches after that. I know Darcy Regier and Lindy Ruff's relationship plays a factor in this question, but what made Lindy Ruff last so long as compared to kind of the different coaches you had throughout the way?
Well, Lindy was a guy that could adjust to many different times and many different systems. From where I first started and the players that he had on the in the locker room to where it was when I left and the players that were there. And also he went through different ownerships, and every time a new owner came in, he would like give him the, you know, it might have been that time after 3-4 years where coaches' lifespan usually is about to run out that they give him a vote of confidence, and then he stuck around. And then, whoop, it's about that same time a year where we're thinking of making a changes, and a new owner comes along. So maybe it was a bit of a luck of the draw there too, but he was, you know, I played for five coaches, mm-hmm. like you said. Really, if you don't really consider the month that I spent in New York,
right.
My last year with Vigneault, really played for four. And I always said Lindy and then John Tortorella were really two hard coaches, but they're the two that I performed the best under because they held me accountable. They were very intense. They were, you know, not shy of using their words in the locker room towards anybody. But that was the type of coach that I need and that I needed at the time. And I performed the best with those two guys.
It's interesting. The other three coaches you played under were Ken Hitchcock, John Stevens, and Scott Gordon. And for our listeners there, and you know, you talk about the Buffalo and then obviously Philly, the Islanders for a period, and then the Rangers. Out of all those teams, Marty, who was the which was the closest team that you played on? And maybe a second part to that, did the closeness lead to success, or do you think the success leads to closeness?
That's a trick question, because the most fun I've had in the locker room were with the bad teams. You know, like my first, you know, my middle years in Buffalo when we were going bankrupt, and that was about as tight and as friendly as I was. I have some of my best friends were on those teams. We were about the same age. We were all about getting engaged and getting married and having kids at the same time. And but we didn't perform. We didn't make the playoffs. But that atmosphere, that close-knit camaraderie, people was the best. The same thing with the Islanders. I mean, that year with the Islanders, if you look at the players that were there at the time, it was Cal Okposo, John Tavares, Matt Molson, Blake Como, Josh Bailey, Mark Streit was there. It was such a good group of players and guys together. Everybody would have gone to war with one another. The Doug Waite, Richard Park, Brendan Witt, they were the veterans. They were just unbelievable, but we just couldn't win any games, and that's just unfortunate. Now, on the other side, if I look back at my last couple of years with the Rangers, I mean, that team was so good, you know, with Henrik Lundqvist and that and all of that, and some of the top-end players. But again, I think that success brought everybody together because we were feeling like we were a family going to play a game. So it changes in the circumstances. It changes in the way it is. So you can't really put your finger on if one breeds the other or whatnot. It could be completely different. You know, there was some issues in Philadelphia. Not everybody got along, and we remembered the years of Dry Island and all of that that they had in Philly. I wasn't there at the time, but I still talked to a lot of the players there, and they went to the Cup. And, you know, I think there was a lot of issues in the locker room, and that's just the way it is. But when you're on the ice, you just play the game, and sometimes talent will take over.
You know, before you retired, Martin, and I'm not sure if you've been asked this, I assume you have, but I haven't yet heard the answer. You played final two games in the preseason last year, or the regular season, excuse me, against San Jose, I believe it was, and then St. Louis. San Jose late in that game, I know Don Cherry talked about it, and Thomas Herdos scored a goal and went through his legs. Did you find that to be a disrespectful? I mean, personally, my opinion on it was, I'm okay with that if it's a 2-1 game, it's a close game, and you try something like that in a blowout game like it was, with you guys having a lot of travel to start the season. It wasn't my idea of a classy move. What was your take on that?
My take on that is I should have stopped it. Really, to be honest with you, after he scored, I was thinking, where is the closest shark so I could two-hand him and maybe get suspended like Jimmy McLennan did and then retire, you know? That would have been... But then I realized I was mad at myself. I was really angry with myself that I did not perform well. I could have made that save. It wasn't a hard save to make. I ended up backing away too deep in my net. I wasn't focused on it, and then he puts in that goal. Now the kid's 19 years old, and then all of a sudden he's got a chance to score 4 goals in an NHL game in his rookie year. I don't care how he scores it. That's just an incredible feat to do. You know, and I go back to some of the great goal scorers in the 90s. I mean, Tim Solani scoring that goal, throwing his glove up in the air and shooting it down. I mean, that was just exciting as a fan to see. I don't care if the goalie liked it or not, and if they thought it was disrespectful or not. That was fun. That was fun to watch. So, you know, for a moment there, I was thinking I wanted to beat up somebody, but then after that, I realized, really, that was just pointing towards me, and I should have stopped it, and I should have been more prepared, ready for it. And it was just the last little bit in my career, and realized at that moment that I was ready to move on to something else, that the enjoyment of the game wasn't the same that it was in the past, and I was ready to do something else.
And you had mentioned at the time, you know, the lockout and the ability to spend, you know, extended time with your family, which obviously as a professional hockey player with all the travel, you're not really able to do. The family played a big part in your decision. Can you expand on that?
It did. I mean, the lockout the year before, the half a season that we missed, really gave me a chance to be at every football game that my son was playing, or that the girls were cheerleading for his team, and be there at Halloween and be there at Thanksgiving and at Christmas and do all of those things. Now, when I left for New York that year, the family stayed back in Buffalo, and I felt that there was a big part of me that stayed back home, but I needed to go and continue what I wanted to do, was to win a Stanley Cup and perform the best I could. Now, the next year when I left in September, and my 5-year-old daughter at the time, you know, having 4 kids, she was the third one in line to start school, and she was starting kindergarten, and her and I are pretty close, and it was heartbreaking to leave the day after she started kindergarten and to go to New York and get maybe a day every 10 days, maybe 3 days a month to be able to come home and visit the family. And when I say coming home, I say taking a 7:30 flight out of New York, being in Buffalo at 9:30, 10 o'clock, and then having to take the 6:30 out of Buffalo to be able to be in New York that night so I can go to practice the next day.
Wow.
So that means spending 8 hours, you know, 3 times a month with the family. That was not what I wanted anymore. You know, at a certain time of your life, you might be able to do that, but it just wasn't my priority anymore. And getting up to go to practice, I love practice. I would have done practice every day of the year because I was still learning. I was still enjoying working with Benny Allaire, the goalie coach there, and Lundqvist, and that feeling was awesome. But to go through 82 games and the travel, and especially the way it started, it was the beginning of the end. And you know, maybe the fact that all those things happened with San Jose and St. Louis, and then having put on waivers because I really wasn't performing, was kind of a blessing in a way that it made my decision a lot easier.
Final question for you, Martin. I really appreciate you joining us today. How are you enjoying the television aspect? I mean, you've retired now. You're providing, in my opinion, great analysis on TSN. How are you enjoying it?
Oh, I'm loving it. I mean, I was always a big student of the game. So I woke up in the morning and I watched every highlight and went back and looked at games and seeing what are some of the new skills and new tools that players are using or that goalies are doing in the game. And that fire and that desire to learn is still so strong inside of me that that's what I bring into my job as an analyst, is to obviously I tend to focus on goalies and on defensive plays and what the breakdowns are for a goal, but I'm learning that now there's so much more to that, to be able to watch a certain players and what they're doing with the puck and how they can be explosive in their skating and what makes, you know, a 20-year-old so much better now than we 20-year-olds were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. There's so many little things in there that I want to be able to tell people and the stories behind it. Now, sometimes I get caught up and I'm so excited about something that I speak gibberish and then people don't understand what I'm saying, but that's just part of my personality and that's fine, you know, but I'm having a great time doing that. I'm having a great time being part of this Academy of Hockey here in Buffalo, with the Pagulas, the Buffalo Sabres and Buffalo Bills owners are putting this building that's almost $200 million. It's in the finishing stage here. We're going to start this academy, and I'm going to go on the ice with, you know, 8-year-old to 18-year-old goalies and teach them the position and develop them and bring that elite focus to goalies here in the Buffalo area and Western New York, Southern Ontario, and all of that. So those are all things that I'm so passionate about. And I'm working harder now at what I want to do than I ever did. Hockey was always something that came easy for me, and I worked, but it just was an easy thing to do. Now I'm working because I love it, and that's a completely different feeling.
Well, Martin, I appreciate you joining us today on the Legal Curve Hockey Show in the second edition of Saturday Spotlight. We think you're doing a great job on TSN, and we hope that the effect you have on the young players in Buffalo and Southern Ontario is similar to the effect that the LAers had on you.
Hopefully, too. It would be a great compliment if I even get to half of that. So thanks for having me, and you know, who knows, maybe I'll stop into your station one of those days and we'll have a real sit-down face-to-face.
I'd be happy to have you. That'd be terrific.
So that is this week's Saturday Spotlight. Richie Pollock, who's not here today, but had a conversation earlier this week with Marty Biron. Fantastic work there from Richie. We'll take a break. When we come back to IC, could Marty Brodeur, speaking of Marty's, end up in Colorado? No. No.
You never know. Stranger things have happened. I've been on the radio for 5 years.
Hey, they need goalies in Colorado. We'll find out if Marty Brodeur is the possible answer there when we return to the Legal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to
the Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Legal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.